Guys, there is a picture that's going to come up on the screen that I think you may well have seen over at some point on the news recently. Anybody seen that picture and indeed the video that goes with it of a woman who has raised this lion as a cub and coming up close to it, and in the video, as the lion puts its paws through the bars, you think, oh, this is going to get ugly. And then instead of that, all of a sudden he starts nuzzling his mane into her and literally kissing her on the lips. And you just think, oh, isn't that amazing? And in fact, it was such a powerful image that some of you might have been seen also the video that they brought out back from the Born Free days. It's pretty amazing, wasn't it? Really incredible. I mean, look, you can tell it's old. I mean, the flares those guys are wearing and that hair. I once remember that. Yes, I remember those days. I do. Purple flares. Nonetheless, let's get back to it. Because that was really astounding, for the simple fact that even as you saw this, you think to yourself, oh, it's a lovely thought, but the bars. Wouldn't it be amazing if there could be no bars? And then you see these two guys who have similarly raised this cub and yet haven't seen it for many years, and you see this lion run towards them and you think, this is more than ugly. There's going to be limbs going off here and there and blood and, you know. Not a pretty sight, and yet the same thing. The lion comes and hugs them and they play with it. And you just think, that is amazing. That is just beautiful. I don't know, but for some of you it might be your vision of an ideal world. But maybe it's something else. I want you to actually just turn to the person next to you, and if you're sitting on your own, you might need to turn and to someone in front or behind, and I want you to share with each other what is the symbol or picture for you of the world as it should be. Would you just take just a minute? You'll only need a minute because you're not going to need to talk a lot about it. It'll be something that maybe you've grown up with as a kid. What is your picture or symbol of an ideal world? Just share that with each other if you would. Come on, I want some of you to share. What were some of the images that... Did that represent it for anyone? Yeah? Oh, that's great. It's beautiful, isn't it? What were some others that people came up with? What's your image of an ideal world? Yeah.
Nay said free beer.
Are you sure that was Nay? Anyone else? Yeah, sure.
I think to love one another.
Seeing people really loving one another, yeah. And look, that's great. It's still a bit too conceptual for me. Give me some concrete things, okay? B is sort of fluid, but I want some concrete things. Sorry? Yep. Yeah, that. Now, what was that remark that came from behind? I want to know. Look, it's true. I think it is really hard to come up with concrete images. Some other people, just share with us what you've had a real go at. No politicians. Yeah, but you're still talking about an absence of something. Give me something positive. Yeah, so similar to that. Anyone else have anything else?
Pain-free.
I heard stop all the wars. Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it, to think of if people truly just loved one another and there was no wars. In fact, there's an image back in the early part of Isaiah, which you might remember we went through on our first week in this series on God's vision statement. in chapter 2 that actually speaks about them beating their swords into plowshares, looking to the day when people will not need weapons. There will be no need. You think about when people talk about disarmament these days and they say, yes, we're moving towards world peace. They're getting rid of 10 missiles, we're getting rid of 10 missiles. Why don't you get rid of all of them? Oh, we can't do that. We might need some. You know, you get the idea, don't you? You know, can you imagine a time where you don't need any weapons? Anyone else come up with anything else? Living in the garden. Okay, living in the garden. I've got to tell you, I've travelled a lot around this country, and the image of desert is a powerful one for me. Imagining when the desert becomes a lush and fruitful garden, when there are no places that are wasted and dead and lifeless. It's a beautiful image. Any others? Rivers of Mars bars and Tim Tams. Now, that may not be concrete, but I tell you what, you're speaking my language. Anything else? I know we had another one out at Castlereagh, the issue of there being no poverty. It's another image that powerfully comes through in the scriptures. The day when you will not need to see a child dying with hunger. That horrible look of extreme malnutrition. These are powerful things. And yet the reality is, ever since we were ejected from the garden, humanity has been fruitlessly in search of this paradise. They call it utopia. Heaven on earth. As we go through life, though, what happens to us? We start off with that beautiful naivety of youth or childhood, infancy. And yet as you go through life, we have the sinfulness of sin ever more pressed into our face. The tragedy of the curse becomes just ever more in front of us. And yet the tragedy of that curse is that it's not simply what has been done out there being put on me, but it's the destruction that I have reaped for what I've done. It comes to us all in the shape of death, that terrible scourge. And as you get older through life, it just comes more and more into view. And so such visions, it's why some people said, Andy said, I can't imagine it. The older you get, it becomes harder and harder to entertain the pictures the Bible gives. Similar to what was read to us by Jim just now. Or the book of Revelation that we've been studying. Well, guys, as we think about Paradise Lost, how hard do you think it would have been for the people to whom Isaiah spoke? Not just the unbelievers in Israel and Judah, but the faithful remnant. How hard would it have been for them to hear the words that Jim has just read in chapter 11? Try and put yourself in their shoes. It's quite amazing to think how hard it would be for them. And especially, I want you with your Bibles, all of you have your Bibles open, and I want you to look just past the passage Jim read to us to chapter 12, verse 1. It should come up on the screen as well. I want your Bibles open with this one today, and I'm just going to show you around a few of these passages that help us to understand this. Chapter 12, verse 1. You will say in that day, so he's saying there is a day when you will say, I give thanks to you, O Lord, for though you were angry with me, your anger turned away, that you might comfort me. How do you reckon people would have gone that Isaiah was speaking to? How would they have gone at hearing that? When in fact the nation is burned to a crisp. Villages flattened, vineyards gone, there is no celebration. The voice of the bridegroom and the bride is absent from the land. It's a fearful picture. Just to help you see what I mean, just come back towards the passage we looked at last week. So turn back two pages to chapter 9. And you might remember this is in the context of the judgments that the Lord is announcing upon Ahaz for his political manoeuvring and complete faithlessness in the Lord. And as he speaks of his judgment that he is bringing and will continue to bring on Israel and Judah, the northern and southern kingdoms, he says there in verse 12, and it should come up on the screen, I think. Says, the Syrians on the east and the Philistines on the west, they devour you with open mouth. And yet for all this, have a look at the underlying words, for all this his anger has not turned away and his hand is stretched out still. And then he goes on. So what's that image? For all this God's anger is not turned away and his hand is stretched out still. His hand is uplifted is literally the word. It's saying as long as his hand is raised, it is raised in judgment over this people. It's similar to when, you remember when the people were in the wilderness and they were at times combating enemies and they came across a powerful enemy and the Lord said, I want Moses to go up on the hill and I want him to lift up his hand, and as long as he lifts up his hands, you will triumph because I will bring my judgment on this other nation. What, of course, happened during the day? Moses standing there with his hands raised and the people are victorious, but he gets tired. So eventually, what do? They get some people to come in and hold his arms up because he is representative of the Lord whose arm is raised. But let me tell you, his arm does not grow tired or weak. He is committed to his judgment. This is a hard thing for us to comprehend, guys, but what it is meant to help us to see is the seriousness of sin, the sinfulness of sin. And so, even though he has brought this judgment, verse 13 says, and yet the people did not turn back to him who struck them or inquire of the Lord of hosts. So the Lord cut off from Israel head and tail. Verse 15, the elder and honoured man is the head, the prophet who teaches lies is the tail. And he's cut them off. And yet go down now in your Bibles, just looking in your Bibles now, it won't be on the screen, to verse 17. This judgment continues, and he says at the end of verse 17, and yet for all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out or uplifted still. And so the judgment continues upon the land. And then at the very end of the chapter, if you look at the end of verse 21, he says, in spite of the continued judgment upon the land, for all this, his anger is not turned away. And then look down at the end of chapter 10, verse 4. The same again. His hand is stretched out still. It is a chorus, a refrain of the most horrible. Judgment is continuing. And only just at the end of chapter 10, if you go right to the end of chapter 10, and we're now into the verses that Jim read to us from verse 33, the top of that column there, on page 575, we have seen Yahweh as being like the lumberjack of the nations. Like a true lumberjack, the Lord goes through the forest of the nations and he considers which tree he will take, just like the lumberjack. Except the Lord, when he is doing it with real nations made up of real people like you and me. And he is saying, I know the time when your sin and the measure of it is filled to the brim, and the time has now come. And so I judge. And it says there in those closing verses of chapter 10 that he lops off the huge boughs of the tree. And then finally he fells it. And you see these images of people that fell these trees. And it is a massive thing. But then finally at the end of it, all you have is the stump. And that is what the nation of Judah is like. It's what it's like. In fact, just duck back, if you would, Kath, to that verse that I skipped over, which you would have seen me skip over and thought, why did he skip over that? Yeah. It's the one I shared with you on the first week. Chapter 1. You don't need to look at it in your Bibles. It's up on the screen if you can see it. Your country lies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, foreigners devour your land. It's desolate, overthrown by foreigners. And the daughter of Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field. Remember I told you about the Jenny Shed up on Crowley's Lane or whatever as you head towards North Richmond? You know, and it's leaning to the side. It just houses a few funnel webs. He's saying that's what the great city of Jerusalem is like now. It is that close to falling. A besieged city. So how can Isaiah in chapter 12, verse 1, speak of comfort, which means salvation? Guys, the answer is in the passage that Jim read to us in chapter 11. Have a look at verse 1 with me. Okay? Bible's open, it won't be on the screen. Chapter 11, verse 1, where he says, "There shall come forth a shoot from the stump." The lumberjack of the nations has passed through, and he has not just felled Israel and Judah. He has felled nations round about, and now he is about to fell the great arrogant nation that he has used to fell these other ones, Assyria. It will fall, but it will never rise again. But there is a different message for the people of God that have been judged for their rejection of him. He says, you may have been felled, but it is so that new life can emerge. Those of you who've got that green thumb, that gardening bug that I certainly haven't, mine's very black, you know how you can prune something till there are no leaves on it, and yet all of a sudden, in just a short time, a shoot. Or how in our Australian bush it can be ravaged by fire, and yet within weeks, the shoots come forth. New life. Now, where does this new life come from? We're told it is a shoot from the stump of Jesse. Okay, Bible trivia. Who's Jesse? Sorry? David's dad. Okay, King David's father. A shoot from the stump of Jesse. Now look, we've seen this image of the stump before. You need to flick back now two pages. I haven't got it on the screen. Chapter 6, verse 13. You remember where we started with Isaiah's vision and his call to ministry? Look at the very last verse. That's all we're looking at. He's saying to Isaiah, you will speak to this people, their hearts will be hard. And he says, how long, O Lord? He says, until the cities lie waste without inhabitant. Until my judgment has come. And then he says, look at the last verse, verse 13 of chapter 6. And he says, though a tenth remain in it, it will be burned again. That thing of my hand is still upraised. The judgments will keep coming upon this land for its sin. But then he says, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains when it is felled, the stump of this nation is holy. Indeed, it is a holy seed which will give new growth. Now, that is the image that's taken up again here in chapter 11. So flick back over your two pages, back to chapter 11. Look again at verse 1. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. Jesse is the holy seed. Does that make sense? He's the one from whom this new life is going to come. A branch from his roots that shall bear fruit. Now this is in complete contrast to the kings that have been in Isaiah's day. We've already looked at Isaiah. Not Isaiah, Uzziah, King Uzziah. We've certainly seen Ahaz last week. Do you see there a king that is holy, that is true? Far from it. Far from it. His political manoeuvring, he's not interested in the Lord. He's made his mind. And his choices and options do not include the Lord anywhere. And yet the fact of the matter is, Ahaz isn't on his own. Even David, the son of Jesse, with whom it began, a man after God's own heart, as he was called, we saw sin in him. His son Solomon, who asked for wisdom, wasn't it a great thing to ask for? The Lord gave it to him in spades, and yet he became so foolish. And every succeeding king has done the same. We keep waiting for a true king. And we're told that the Lord is going to bring forth this growth by going right back before all the pomp and pride of these earthly kings, right back to the source, right back to the humble beginnings, back when David was a nobody, a shepherd boy. His dad, he goes back to Jesse. And from there comes the promise of a true king. And let's have a look at his character in verse 2 of chapter 11 there. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. The spirit of wisdom and understanding, counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Indeed, his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. What a different character this will be. How different from Ahaz. The contrast is meant to be there in spades for the people. What will he do? Let's have a look. Continue in the second half of verse 3. He will not judge by what his eyes see or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. Have a look at the first part of that. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide disputes by what his ears hear. He won't be like Ahaz, who would hear the threats of his neighbours and go, oh, I don't like this. What'll I do? Isaiah, will you just be quiet? I'm trying to work out what I'm going to do. I know, Assyria, the king of Assyria, he'll help me. He's such a great guy. And off he goes to the king of Assyria. It's no wonder in chapter 8 he says, do not call controversy what this people calls controversy. Fear the Lord alone. Be in awe of him and no one else. That's what this true king will be. He's not going to decide disputes with bias, but with righteousness. And notice there that he says, it's going to be big. He's going to do it for the whole earth. It goes on and says, he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. Psalm 2. And with the breath of his lips, he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt. Faithfulness around his waist. Guys, this is really quite amazing. We see, therefore, his roots, his character, and his actions. Now, when will it be? Let's just get into that question. When will it be? When will we see this? Put yourself in Isaiah's shoes. What's he hoping for? Well, let me tell you. Ahaz's son, the crown prince, Hezekiah, is probably at this point when he says these words about 6 or 7 years old. And he is by his dad's side, I reckon, when he hears a lot of the messages of Isaiah, because Isaiah was certainly out of the aristocracy. He had access to the people in high places. I reckon Hezekiah, we don't know it, but I reckon Hezekiah heard these things. And I reckon Hezekiah hated what his dad had done. And he heard these words of Isaiah. And when he finally ascended the throne, it says that in his very first year of his reign, he got rid of the idols out of the temple. He cut down his father's Asherah poles. So was it going to be him? We're told he was like his father David. We're told there'd never been any like him before. Is he going to be the one? Is he the true king? As we'll see next week, you know already the answer's no. Not just because you know the PS, you know that Jesus came, but because of the fact that we see that sin is in us and it keeps showing itself again and again and again. It's pressed up to our face, close and personal. And so finally, as king after king after king goes by, the people would despair. Will this ever come? Can you put yourself in the shoes of the people who would have heard the news about John the Baptist, who would have heard the news about Jesus? In John chapter 1, we're told that Jesus chooses Philip and Andrew as his disciples, and Philip goes to find his brother Nathanael. And as he finds him, he comes up to him with such excitement. Nathanael, who's sitting under a tree taking a snooze, goes, "Philip, what are you worrying me about? I'm just having a wonderful power nap." And Philip says, "There's no time for that. He's here. He's here. We found the Messiah." And except for the fact that he seems so really enthusiastic, Nathanael thinks it's a Monty Python joke. I really think the life of Brian is extremely close to the mark. I think it is how they felt. Nathanael, seriously, he looks at Philip, puts his head on the side and goes, waiting for a smile. Oh, come on, mate. But when he maintains his fervour, Nathanael says, "Okay, where is he from?" "He's from Nazareth." "Well, there you go, right from the start. Don't you know anything? The Messiah will be from the city of David, for he comes forth from David's loins. Haven't you worked it out yet? Nothing good comes out of Nazareth, and yet what would he find out?" Can you put yourself in his shoes and think about how the hair stands on the back of your neck as you realise he fulfills it all? You'll never, ever be the same again. And yet, can I tell you, when I ask the question there in your outlines, when will it be? When will this true promised king do these things? Can I say it's not in Jesus' first coming? That is just 3 years of public ministry to a handful of people in a small patch of dirt in a backwater part of the world. And yet what we are reading about here is global. The things that we are reading about here, while Jesus, yes, deals in justice and righteousness, what he will, in bringing this to the earth, he has only showed that he is the one. He has not yet done it. When we read it of chapter 12, verse 1, "In that day." Well, guys, the fact of the matter is, this passage is speaking solely about the return of Jesus. What we still have not yet experienced. But what difference will it make? Let's have a quick look at verses 6 to 9 before we bring things to an end. He says, "The wolf shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them." Guys, this is even greater than what you see here with the video clips that we've seen on our TV screens. This is amazing. Forget about lions and leopards. Every one of you here who has raised a child, you've seen your child as a youngster want to go after just a dog. And what have you done? "Oh no, no, sweetheart. You're not gonna lead and walk that doggy. You just come here and you're a bit sus about this dog. You're not letting that dog and your child anywhere near each other." You've heard too many stories and too many news reports. And yet here we hear a child shall lead not just the doggy, but the lion. What a difference. What a transformation. We're talking about creation in this image. We're talking about not just harmony with nature, world peace, the end of poverty. We are talking about the restoring of all creation. The stuff that Andy so rightly said, I can't imagine it. Where will it be? Have a look at verse 10. Got to go just over the page. It says, in that day, notice, same as chapter 12, verse 1, in that day. So in the same day that all of this happens, in that day the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire. But it says there, he shall stand as a signal for the peoples, or the word is literally a banner or a flag. We do not comprehend this because we don't come from a place that has wars, horrible wars, hand-to-hand combat. You want a picture of this? You know the movie to go and see? You know Mel Gibson's movie, The Patriot? Right? It's not for looking at if you haven't got a strong stomach. Right? But the fact of the matter is, there is a point in this movie where these people, led by this incredibly brave and convicted and courageous warrior, our Mel, he launches right up the middle of this vast army. And as they fly into this army, the flag, the person who is the flag bearer, now the flag bearer, how many shields and rifles and all of that does the flag bearer hold? None. And the flag bearer goes down. But our Mel, he's not worried about the fact that he's got to put down his guns and his shields and everything to do this flag. He's not worried about his safety. He knows that that flag is the most important thing because it is that to which the people rally. And so he goes and he grabs the flag and he lifts it up and he runs. And he stands and the people see the banner and they run to it. Guys, it's a powerful image. And we are told that in that day, when our true king has defeated the enemies, he shall raise the banner. And all those who have trusted in him will flock to him. But it won't just be a faithful remnant of Jews. Where is it going to be? The amazing thing here is that it's not just about a piece of dirt in a backwater part of Palestine. This is gone global. There are no borders. God's vision is way too big for that. You won't need a passport. There will be no customs. Not in God's holy mountain. Go back to verse 9 with me. Our final spot. He says, verse 9, they shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. In all my holy mountain. The mountain of the Lord will finally be seen for what it is. What is this mountain of the Lord? How big is it? Have a look. Have a look up here. Right at the end of the book. What we studied in Revelation, chapter 21, verse 9 and 10, then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues. In other words, the end of God's judgment. And he spoke to me saying, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb, the people of God, the children of the Father. And he carried me away in the Spirit to a great high mountain. And showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Guys, the mountain of God is the whole earth. And who will live there? Those who trust in this true king. We have what Isaiah didn't have. We have the benefit of hindsight. We don't yet see the end, but you have seen his first coming. You have seen his life and death and resurrection and ascension. And guys, do you think that having done the hard part, he's going to squib out on doing the end of the job? His first coming guarantees his second. How many people have been enjoying watching the Olympics? Yeah? I love them. Not just all the events and, you know, the great stories and the slow motion camera footage that you just think, wow. Right? But the fact of the matter is, the one thing that always bugs me is that the Olympics are the closest thing we have to the Tower of Babel. It is humanity's push to say, we're doing it. Paradise will not be lost. We will have it, and we will have it by our own hand. Utopia is coming. Heaven on earth, and was there a mention of God? No. We don't need him. What have you thought as you've seen it? Do you think they're making headway? Or do you see through it? If they're not proven, do you know the drug cheats? Do you see the pollution? The security crackdowns? The girl with the crooked teeth substituted for someone who's far more appealing to the mass media audience? And you know that this utopia is only skin deep. My brothers and sisters, do not be deceived. There may be thousands here in Cranbrook that are not here yet. But you are focused on the true King. Don't ever forget it. And know that in that day, you will rejoice. And as you live today, in the light of that day, you will be a light to those who live in darkness.